You're listening to Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness, a podcast about domestic violence, sponsored by Randy's House of Angels. Domestic or intimate partner violence is a complex and silent epidemic that affects millions of people worldwide. To respond to the overwhelming issues associated with domestic violence, Randy's House of Angels has produced a series of podcasts that will bring this epidemic to the forefront of public consciousness and break the silence that often shrouds it. This is Paul Miller, producer of this program, and by creating a dedicated platform, Randy's House of Angels hopes to create a safe space for survivors, advocates, and experts to share their stories, insights, and knowledge. A series of topics will be discussed that can offer vital support and resources to victims and survivors, helping them realize that they are not alone and that there is help available. It can also serve as a catalyst for raising awareness and fostering necessary conversations within families, communities, and institutions to empower individuals, foster empathy, and inspire collective action toward eradicating domestic violence while creating a safer, more compassionate society. We invite you to access the podcast by going to randyshouseofangels.org. Today, we are discussing how police officers handle these often high-stakes situations where domestic violence occurs. What are the challenges they face in protecting victims while ensuring due process? What does lethality assessment protocol mean to a victim? The importance of trauma-informed responses and the collaboration with social services and advocacy organizations are subjects on today's podcast. What training and resources that officers need to handle domestic violence incidents effectively also is discussed. Joining us today is Detective Danelle Owen. Detective Owen is an experienced detective with the East Pennsboro Police Department. She was formerly the patrol sergeant with a demonstrated history of working in the public safety industry. She is skilled in government, law enforcement, emergency management, field training, and community policing. She is a strong military and protective services professional with a master's degree focused in criminal justice from American Public University. The facilitator of today's podcast is Dr. Ellen Smith. Ellen Smith, MD, retired after 30 years of teaching and practicing family medicine in the Harrisburg area. Her undergraduate studies were at Hollins University, and she completed her medical degree at the Penn State University College of Medicine in Hershey, PA. In addition, she completed a family medicine residency at Lancaster General Hospital. Since retiring, she has studied adversity, how a traumatized brain works, and how to bounce back and become more resilient. She is passionate and appreciative of the opportunity to educate thousands of people about these topics. She also volunteers at the Trinity Preschool of Harrisburg, a grant-funded, inner-city, trauma-informed preschool. Finally, she has developed a tool called the Personal Resilience Planner, which takes the above concepts and provides a practical way to look at strengths, trauma responses, resilience, and how to progress in these areas over time.
Welcome, Detective Owen. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. We're going to talk today about domestic violence, specifically the role of law enforcement. Of course, you're a detective. What took you to becoming a law enforcement officer?
Well, it's actually kind of a funny story. I never had any desire to become an officer. I actually had every desire to become a tax attorney. So my background, actually, my bachelor's degree is in accounting, and then I took my LSATs to continue on to law school. But accounting classes are really boring, so I actually declared a double major in criminal justice and in accounting, and I loved the criminal justice classes. And after I did my internship in a department down in York County, I fell in love, and I said, okay, this is exactly what I want to do.
Oh, that's so wonderful that you found what you needed, and I'm guessing that at least most of the time being an officer is not particularly boring.
Oh, I don't think there's any boring day. I pray for boring days, but they don't happen.
Great, great. So we're going to jump right in and talk about the very high-stakes situations that you're in, but particularly focused on the domestic violence situations, which may or may not be different, if you could speak about them.
I mean, there's a ton of different domestic violence situations. I mean, you have female on male, male on female, children, all sorts of different situations. And every single time you go into a situation, there's nothing that is identical to the last one. So every single time, they're the most volatile situations that we encounter because you're walking into the unknown. You already are dealing with people who are mad and their anger is heightened. So it doesn't matter who you are walking into that room, they're already frustrated and potentially violent. So it's always one of those scary situations that we deal with.
And is there often substance abuse with all of this?
A lot of times, yes. A lot of alcohol, a lot of drugs, but it doesn't matter sometimes. It's just sometimes how the people were raised. You know, if a kid grows up in a household where there's domestic violence that goes on the daily, then they just think that's the way it's supposed to be. So they may grow into that domestic violence situation already.
Interesting. And then you have, in some, if not many situations, you have children who are victims and who are living through this. Can you speak about that a bit?
Yeah, and it's pretty much what I just kind of mentioned, you know. And this is one of the most difficult things, because when we walk into a room, our primary goal is to make sure that these kids are not in a bad position, and we want to make sure that they're shielded from anything that's going on. But at the same time, we have to ensure our safety and the safety of the other people. And it's very unfortunate because our eyes are everywhere. So if we have to take somebody into custody, if we have to stop the violence immediately, and there's a kid in the room, that view, what the kid is seeing, may impact their future, their thoughts on law enforcement. It could impact a whole bunch of different things. So it's a really difficult situation for us to have to deal with.
So you're trying not to further traumatize children, but sometimes that happens because you have to provide safety to people or protect other people and potentially handcuff folks and potentially the parents or loved ones of the children.
Right. And sometimes, you know, there's situations where we might have to use some sort of less lethal force, like a taser. And I know there was a situation many years ago. There was a gentleman who was very high on cocaine. He was drunk. He was being very violent with his family. I got him in custody. He had two kids present. I got him into the back of my car, but then he was kicking out my back window, and he ended up having to get tased. His kids were there, and that made an impact on the kids for the rest of their lives. I know that a few years later, I had to go do a little presentation at a daycare center, and his kids happened to be in that room, and the one kid was terrified when she saw me. They pulled me aside and said, "Apparently you tased their dad." And I said, "I only ever tased one person in the 18 years that I've been here." And it just so happened, here I am talking to her kid or their kid, and she's terrified of me. So it's an unfortunate consequence of what we do, but it had to have been done, because what else can we do?
Right. There would be more danger if you hadn't tased him.
Correct.
Yeah. And do you often go into schools and talk about what you do and things like that?
There's a lot of times the schools ask us for presentations just so we can educate and inform the kids. They oftentimes like to send the female officers because we look a little bit less threatening than the males. We have not done that recently. There's a lot of daycares that have not contacted us for that, but we do try and interact with the kids as often as we can just to show them that we're the good guys.
Right. That makes sense. Now, I read about something called the Lethality Assessment Protocol, and that's relatively new. Can you speak about that and how that would be helpful for those on the podcast who are learning about domestic violence and or experiencing, or perhaps they're violent themselves?
So the Lethality Assessment Protocol, that is something for law enforcement officers. When we go to a domestic violence situation, we have to go through this protocol and answer the questions. And I can't speak to the exact questions off the top of my head, but there are yes or no questions, and then we score them. If they score over a certain amount, it's something where we then make a referral, or otherwise, and this is to domestic violence services, or we can actually just hand the phone to the victim and have them call and talk to domestic violence services right away. It has its pros and cons. A lot of times it's telling us that we need to have the victim call, but the victims sometimes are too afraid right then and there. So I feel like sometimes there would be a great deal of benefit if we could remove them from the situation and then have them call. So there's a lot of fine tuning going on with this protocol. But, you know, when you're right there in the same position that you just were, where you just were getting hurt, it's difficult for people to kind of disassociate themselves with what just happened and think that if they say something, they're not going to get hurt again.
Mm. Wow. And I would think that it's hard just to even think straight immediately after such a situation. You are in your fight, flight, and freeze. And so to imagine having a valid conversation with someone on the other end of the phone who wants to help you but doesn't feel very safe at the time,
right,
I think is important.
And especially on the phone, because you don't see that person.
Right.
Even though they sound nice, your trust is down. So it's hard to answer those questions and just trust that person.
Right, right. Has that been helpful in general or specifically as an officer to help you with making decisions that are more useful, or still working through it, or maybe that's your gestalt that you already have because you have experience?
I would say, I'm not going to say it's useful or not useful. I don't think it's as useful for officers, at least experienced officers, to help make their decisions, because it's not really our decisions that it's impacting. Those decisions are whether or not this person needs to speak to domestic violence. And it's more of a trying to, I don't want to say force them into that situation, but get them direct contact with domestic violence services. We know the law when we go into the situation, so we know whether or not we're going to arrest the person. So it has nothing to do with us, and it's all about the victim.
I think that's great that the victim is getting additional support if they want it.
Right.
Now, over the years, we've heard how things have changed in various ways, domestic violence, juvenile probation. What's changed over time with domestic violence from your point of view?
Well, the domestic violence situations seem to have gotten a little bit more violent over the years. And I'm not even sure what to attribute that to, other than maybe the harder drugs that people are using. It's just seemed to have become so mainstream, which is unfortunate. However, at the same time, I question if it's just more reports are actually getting made now because they know that there is help out there. So maybe there was just so much, I'll call it closet domestic violence that was going on that just never was reported. As far as help, we are able to help people much more because there are so many more services that exist out there, just like that protocol that we were just talking about. There's just things that are in place and things and education for officers so we can recognize things and help the victims rather than just kind of sit back and expect them to get the help on their own.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. Any other things in terms of the changes over the years?
As far as domestic violence goes?
Yes, as far as domestic. Unless you want to speak otherwise,
no.
They would be helpful for our group.
Well, there's a host of things. I mean, one of the biggest things that I will mention, I deal a lot with the child crimes. Children also can be victims of domestic violence, so I'll kind of speak on behalf of that. Any crime that involves a child, there is things in place to interview those children properly. So there's a place locally that's called the Children's Advocacy Center, and kids go there for a forensic interview, so it's not leading questions asked by officers. And then through that process, they get mental health treatment, they get a medical exam, and then every month we have a huge team. It's called the Multidisciplinary Investigative Team that comes together, and we kind of put all our ideas out on the table. We talk about what can we do better, what can we change, how can we investigate this, should this be investigated, and just have these conversations. So what we're noticing is there's more and more of these teams that are popping up. So I wouldn't be surprised if eventually we start looking at something like this with domestic violence. We actually have the same thing with children death investigations. Doesn't matter how the child may have passed away. It could just be from something medical. But we have a large team of law enforcement, nurses, doctors, EMTs, coroner's office, where we have these discussions to try and figure out how can we prevent this from happening in the future. So I would not be surprised if we develop this team for domestic violence. How do we prevent this domestic violence? How can we teach people what signs to look for, and how can we help prevent this?
Did you know that Randy's House of Angels has served over 350 children since 2012? Go to randyshouseofangels.org to learn more about programs offered to children that are victims and or exposed to domestic violence. Programs are offered at no cost to parents and guardians in six central PA counties, including Cumberland, Perry, York, Dauphin, Lebanon, Berks, and Adams. Contact Nancy Chavez at 717-503-4498 or email randyshouseofangels@gmail.com for more information.
So a theme that you've spoken of is better systems, and specifically with the Child Advocacy Center, if a parent has a child that needs support, we've got much better support, and the child will be interviewed by people who know how to do that type of interview, no leading questions, and get some help. And so we've talked over the podcast about the stigma of silence and the stigma of domestic violence. And so there's definitely some comfort in that. If I had a child who had experienced domestic violence, either seeing it or being violated, that's a really wonderful system, it sounds like, that has been developed recently.
Yeah, and those referrals have to come from law enforcement. But one of the biggest things is, even as a witness, so, you know, the situation we were talking about a little bit ago where, you know, actively there's an assault going on, the child is in the room, a referral from law enforcement should still be made, and that interview can be done as to what the child saw. And on top of that, it helps the child get that mental health treatment. So it starts trying to stop that viewpoint and that philosophy that this behavior is okay. So that is one thing that is new to patrol officers. They're not recognizing that they can also use the Children's Advocacy Center in those same situations. But I am trying to work with at least our department to push this. So when they have a child that's present and who has witnessed something, please send them so that they can get some help.
And then the Child Advocacy Center can help determine how much help and what help the child needs. That doesn't need to be, am I correct? It doesn't need to be the officer. You get them to the right place.
Correct.
And then go from there.
Yeah, the officer doesn't do it at all. The officer makes the referral, and then it's kind of incumbent on the family to then get the child there. Now, the officer will be present during the interview and watch it through a different room and audiovisual recordings, but otherwise it's on the family to make all those decisions and take them there.
And as an officer, and now you're a detective, you and your fellow officers have probably seen a lot, and I'm guessing that could really affect you. How do you take care of yourselves? And again, not just take care of yourself, get help from people, because when it's yourself, it's hard to take care of yourself.
That is very true. Everybody takes care of themselves different ways. Unfortunately, it is a stigma among people to get mental health help. Like, mental health help should be like a requirement across the board. Everybody could use a little bit. Men are habitually the worst ones to try and seek any assistance. So I can't answer as to what the majority of the male officers do, but I can answer for myself. We all have different ways.
Right.
So one thing I can just start off by saying is, people don't understand, law enforcement officers have the most sick sense of humor. So we will go to a call where, you know, it's not appropriate to laugh and joke about what's going on. But we have to desensitize ourselves and make a joke out of it, or else we're going to just not be in good health after a short period of time. We see the ugliest things that anybody has ever seen, things that people don't want to have nightmares about, or don't even have nightmares about, because it's so gruesome in some situations. For me, my getaway is actually working more, and it's probably not healthy in some sense, but I enjoy that, and it helps me get my mind off of things and focus on something else. So as long as everybody has something that is their escape, that's a healthy escape, that's what people tend to do. There are also new, I guess they're mental health professionals that are focused on specifically law enforcement and firefighters, EMTs, because again, they see some very gruesome, ugly things, and you can't go to just your general mental health professional and talk about it because they don't understand. You know, I tried one time and we spent probably 45 minutes with this person who was trying to understand my work schedule and my husband's work schedule, because he also, at the time, was a 12-hour shift schedule person, and we were having problems with childcare, which was creating other issues. And she just didn't understand. We spent so much time, and I'm like, we're literally getting to talk about nothing other than our schedule. And she didn't understand why we just couldn't work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And it was really frustrating. So the best thing that has ever happened was a lot of these law enforcement professionals that go into, or other professionals that just go into mental health geared towards first responders.
That sounds like a fantastic idea, to have people who understand not only the schedules, but more importantly, the what you do and the what you see and the jokes. And again, you're not joking on somebody or about somebody. You're just joking about the, you know, the life experiences that you have at the, on the job and,
right,
and the like. So something that goes through my mind is, we've talked along the way about being trauma-informed. And is that a term that is being used in law enforcement, and what does it look like?
Yeah, trauma-informed is taught almost every single year in mandatory in-service updates for us. So every year we're required to have continuing education, which will update us on the laws. It will update us on various topics. So they will pick a topic where they think law enforcement needs more education. So, I mean, we've done everything from helping the elderly to child victims. Believe it or not, I actually just recorded a video about trauma-informed responses. So there was a continuing education course that was developed that is available on our training site that can be taken online. And I was a wonderful actor in that video. But that was all about trauma-informed responses and, you know, how to approach victims and how to question victims. Like I mentioned, I've been here for 18 years. It has changed dramatically. Just the way that we talk to people, the patients that I see from everybody, I mean, on the law enforcement side, the patients we're much more patient and understanding of the situation. So it's very, very victim-centered anymore.
So everybody who's listening may or may not know a lot about trauma-informed. So could you give some examples of how, whatever the scenario would be, how you would approach a situation that you would say is trauma-informed, or perhaps how you used to approach it to how you approach it now, if you feel that's appropriate?
Well, my best scenario that I can use is these children. So the interviews that we would do with children would be, we're just interviewing them. We're not getting down on their level. We're just standing there with our pen and paper and just asking them questions over and over and over, and it is what it is. That's how it used to be. Now, we approach the victims a little bit differently, especially children. You know, we'll sit down with them, we talk with them, we build rapport, we bring them like little stickers or whatever, and just kind of have a conversation with them. But this is where that CAC, then the Children's Advocacy Center, pops in, and we only get minimal facts, and then we refer it over. But it's the same thing with victims of domestic violence. You know, we just approach the situation a little bit differently. We're not pushing them for answers. We allow them to speak at their rate. Like, if they're not ready to talk about everything, we're not going to push it. Whereas before, we're like, well, we need to know everything right this second, or we're not able to help you. So it's dramatically changed.
And does the cadence with which you speak, or the intensity, obviously after the scene is stabilized or whatever the proper word is, does that change at all? You mentioned that you would sit down with a child and an adult, or you might perhaps not be as face-to-face, so it's less threatening, but cadence and the language and things like that?
I will say we do our best. So it should, but when you're talking to a victim and you just came out of a heated situation, maybe you had to wrestle with the bad guy. Well, now one of those people are going to have to break free to then talk to the victim. Our energy is super high at that moment, so it's really difficult to kind of back that down. But we're supposed to kind of like calm ourselves, maybe take a little bit of a drink of water. And then again, it's all about rapport building. And we need to make sure that we're getting people to trust us, because we are not the bad guys. We are really, truly the good guys. I don't make the laws. I know people get upset with me about the speed limit. I didn't create it. It's not my fault. You just have to kind of view things a little bit different, realize that everybody's situation in life is different, and kind of put yourself somewhere else and like just understand that you are not talking to somebody that is coming from the same background that you are. You have to understand that this is somebody that's different, and you just have to kind of find that happy space. And sometimes, you know, you just might not hit it off with a victim. People and cops are starting to understand that you can kind of tap out. Like, you can ask for a different resource, which is where a lot of times the officers are asking for me, especially if I'm dealing with like a sex assault victim. The guys don't want to be involved. And to be honest, I don't want the guys involved because habitually the offenders are typically male. I'm not saying all the time. And the victims are typically female, not all the time. But that's the typical what we see. Men don't feel comfortable talking about that stuff with a woman. So they usually tap out, call me and say, can you please talk to this person? And I have no problem with that. So it's good for both the victim. It's good for, you know, the comfort of the officer. And it still gets things done. And that's how we need to handle it.
Right. You want to get things done and want them to be done well.
Correct.
Which you said something I think I want to just showcase is that you're human. You're all jacked up. The folks in the room are all jacked up. There's no way you can immediately become 100% calm, but you have some resources of take a drink of water, intentionally calm yourself, and then show up to the best of your knowledge, but also know when you need to take a little bit more time, whatever that might be, 20, 30 seconds, I'm guessing.
Right, yeah.
And
It can always vary, and it just depends on how serious the situation was.
Oh, of course. Wow. Any other things that I haven't mentioned that you want to talk about, whether it be about being an officer or as a detective? You might even comment on what a detective does that's different than an officer.
Well, as far as a detective, my job is much more detail-oriented. Some days I will tell you it's not nearly as fun. I enjoyed those days on the street where I could kind of get in, do the down and dirty, do what I needed to do, and kind of move on. And that's what patrol officers really do. Their job is to respond, to quickly help people, and then they have to go to their next call. And we're not in an area that we just sit on our hands all day and wait for that one call every shift. You know, especially in the summer, we're talking about 26 plus calls at a time, or not at a time, but in a shift. My job is to take the information that patrol then sends back to me to then conduct an investigation. So we have 3 detectives in our department. My job is primarily focused on child crimes and sex crimes. The majority of my cases come from child lines, but I also still do get a lot of the sex crimes that are referred to me from patrol that had taken the initial report. It's not as glorious as it sounds. You know, Law and Order makes it look so great and so wonderful. There's a lot of downtime in sitting behind a desk, which is not what I signed up to do. But at the same time, I get very happy when I can finally solve a crime and arrest a guy that has hurt a child, hurt a woman, or vice versa, or a female that's done the same thing. There's nothing that makes me feel happier about my job than being able to get the victims some justice. And the way that I interact with my victims is much different than what patrol officers would. So when I'm dealing with my victims, we have a much longer lasting relationship. So my victims end up getting my personal cell phone number. I'm available 24/7 to them because I want to be available. I want to make sure that they have that support system because they've already built a relationship with me. And I want to make sure I'm available. It never crosses the line, but I'm always, you know, I'm always there to give them a little bit of guidance. Sometimes it's very exhausting for me. So really, I'm never off duty. It's just, it's a good thing and a bad thing. But there are days I just go home and I just am like, I'm ready to quit. I'm ready to just hang it up because I just want a break. But it's okay.
Yeah. Thank goodness you are still at it. You haven't quit. And hopefully you take some vacations and you turn off the phone and let it be. I'm intrigued that you are at the other end of the child line calls or however they come in. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I've actually called child line a couple of times as a physician.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. Physicians are probably among the most difficult to deal with when I'm dealing with child
lines. I'm sure.
So when you make a report to child line, what happens is that then goes to the child line center, wherever that is. I think they're mostly working at home. But then it's then routed to the county that needs to investigate it. There are three different kinds of child lines. There's a GPS, a CPS, and an LEO. So a GPS is general protective concerns. So this is going to be somebody who's living in a house, using a bunch of drugs, and has a kid involved. Those are not considered law enforcement situations, which is kind of weird to me because, you know, drugs are illegal in most circumstances. Then you have a CPS, which is Child Protective Services. That is where law enforcement and children and youth join forces. And then you have LEO only, which is just law enforcement because that person was not in a caregiver situation. So I get two of the three forms. And every single time we get one in our township, it's sent to all of our detectives, but I'm primarily the one that handles all of them. From that point, if it's a CPS that I'm working with children and youth, we kind of work together and have a discussion of how we want to proceed with this. Sometimes it requires a CAC interview, and sometimes it doesn't. So what I always explain to parents at the end of a CAC interview is children and youth and I, we work parallel. So if you view it and think about it, it's kind of like driving down the interstate. We're going down the interstate. My exit might be before theirs. Their exit might be before mine. Either way, we're riding parallel next to each other, and one of us might exit first. So that is how we conduct those investigations. We're both doing the same thing, but for different purposes. And then LEO, that is just me investigating, and I handle it and move forward. It's just going to be potentially a crime. Still can go to the CAC for the interview and then go from there.
So either one, both of those would involve a child, but just in different fashions.
Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic. Anything we haven't talked about that perhaps the public comes and asks you about or you'd like the public to know?
I would love for the public to know and understand a couple different things. Everybody that's in law enforcement, no one got into this job to go, I think I'm going to kill somebody today. That's not our job. That's not our goal. We never want to fire our firearm. We don't want to use any kind of use of force. Our goal when we started this job is to serve and protect, and that is legitimate. The problem is sometimes we've talked about the mental health aspect. Sometimes we're coming from, you know, seven different prior calls that were all things that got us completely amped up. And now you're complaining about your mailbox and we're not the nicest human on the face of the earth because, you know, we just got spit on or kicked or arrested the most volatile guy, but we're not coming to you and saying, hey, this is what I just did. Can you just have a little grace? I mean, I did do that one time, but I wish everybody could understand that we are treating you based on, unfortunately, the situations that we might have just walked out of. We're not mean people. We're not trying to hurt people. And it bothers us when, you know, people just think we're being mean because we want to. There's no day that I've ever heard the guys go out and go, oh, I think I'm going to go be mean to everybody today. Like, that's not a thing. So they have to understand that we are human as well. We put our pants on the exact same way everybody else does, one leg at a time. We're there to help and not hurt.
That's so foundational. And we do need to be reminded about that. And thank you. And, you know, you are human and we're all human and we have good days and bad. And you have a whole lot more difficult calls ahead of your, you know, behind you each day. And thank you so much. This has been very thought provoking for me, Detective Owen. And I wish you all the best and thank you for your service.
Thank you. I appreciate coming in and talk to you about it.
Great.
Randy's House of Angels is sponsoring Season 3 of a series of podcasts that will serve as a resource to anyone impacted by domestic violence, including parents, guardians, caseworkers, health providers, advocates, teachers, trauma specialists, clinicians, and more, to provide an overview of domestic violence and how to handle situations where domestic violence is present. Season 3 will include a series of 5 podcasts that will include an overview in addressing the mental health stigma in domestic violence situations, the influence of pop culture on domestic violence, looking at the harmful tropes and changing narratives, and addressing trauma-informed juvenile probation and breaking the cycle for youth. The podcast will include testimony and stories from experts that work in the domestic violence field, criminal justice, juvenile justice, and social work academia. The podcast will be broadcasted starting in August of 2025 and run through October of 2025. Go to Randy's House of Angels website at randyshouseofangels.org. There, you can catch up on any podcast you've missed, find additional resources that support the podcasts, and we encourage you to click on the link and take our short survey. Your feedback is essential to shaping and informing future episodes of this show.